A Map of the World, Disc 3.
Howard and I had moved around each other with exaggerated care, unsure of what lay beyond politeness. He went out in the morning, and that's when I put my head in my pillow and stared into the blank white cotton. In the last 2 days, when he had come in from chores, he had found me sputtering apologies. He had told me to please be quiet more than once. There was no arguing, no shouting and indignation, because he'd told me to stop talking. He knew what was proper. It was stupid to invoke the spirit of the dead lamb, Buster, we had called him, which Nellie had served for dinner in the form of chops. It was cowardly to suggest that we dry up the cows and go somewhere for a few weeks until the worst was over. "Please, Alice," he had said. "Let's just keep quiet and get through this." I hadn't realized at first, in line, that Howard's lower lip was trembling, that he was fighting to compose himself. As he turned away from me, I understood that none of the last week had been real for him until now. He wiped his nose on his new sleeve. I felt as if I could see through his suit, to his hairless chest that, despite his supernatural strength, had always reminded me not of hard, manly strength, but of china, smooth white china that would shatter if you weren't careful. I remembered how at the hospital Howard had said that he felt we were outside of time and circumstance. And then, after it was over, back at home, he had had his blissful routine, hours in which work was rest. He had done the chores alone, thankful, I'm sure, for the numbing tasks. His rusted irrigation rig was leaking and the cow had prolapsed. He hadn't wanted to call the vet and spend at least $100 just to see him show up, so he had pushed the uterus back in and sewed her with a shoelace and a darning needle and given her a shot of penicillin. It was probably unheard of for a dairy farmer to take that kind of risk with such an expensive animal. If she died from infection, he would be so sorry he meddled. And if she got through it, he would be a champion farmer. The last few days for Howard had been made up of action. It stood to reason, then, that for him the church service was the time to feel. Maybe he was remembering how we had seen Lizzie in the hospital nursery when she was 4 hours old. There was one photo album and the video of the second birthday party. Her face was covered with white frosting. A balloon popped, and she cried. Dan and Teresa had probably spent their time since her death talking together about what a fine baby she had been, how she crawled and stood and walked. Irrepressible she was, all in the same month. They would shake their heads and wonder at how extraordinary she'd been. They'd go over and over their little stockpile of stories until there was no point in repeating them. They swore they would keep her memory alive, swore it and swore it. But she slipped away even as they spoke. Maybe they'd have other children and move to a different state. When Audrey was a teenager, she would occasionally remember that there'd been a sister who had drowned in the neighbor's pond, the baby who was frozen in the photograph in the den. I remember feeling as if I was at quite a distance from the gathering, that I was much more composed than I should have been. Teresa, who knew from her practice as a family therapist, had told me once that feelings are never wrong. Emotions in varying degrees exist, of course, and have to be acknowledged. But they, in and of themselves, she said, do not have moral weight and should never be judged. That was more latitude than I could ever give myself, and I knew full well that my composure, the unreasonable calm, was wrong. I stood in line calculating how I was going to pay the formal respects. It would have been far preferable to be downstairs in the church basement, cutting the cake in preparation for the lunch, or standing guard over the formidable coffee urn. I had offered, that is, Howard had offered for me. He had dialed and redialed numerous times until he finally got through to the Collins' house. Teresa had told him that there were plenty of people to cover the bases. "To cover the bases?" I had said. And Howard, because Nellie was standing in the doorway, didn't reply. He rolled his eyes up and blinked, and then he left the room. There was nothing more to say to Lizzie's relatives. Teresa and Dan's life would be forever changed. I couldn't do effective CPR, hadn't been organized enough to know where I put my swimming suit, couldn't take care, was a heathen who barely knew how to pray. "I'm sorry" wouldn't really suffice. My damp shirt was sticking to my stomach, and my wrist still smelled of the new Calvin Klein perfume, Escape, that I had found at Hutchins in the magazine. Howard's mother had ironed the flowered skirt, and I had shaved my underarms as well as my legs with great care, with the fear that one unsightly black nub would be taken as a sign of disrespect. I was tall, and fought, without much success, the habit of slouching. In line, I stood erect. I reached up and pulled my hair out of its rubber band, and smoothed it through the circle of my fingers, and refastened the band. It was then that I saw Mrs. Mackesy, several yards behind us. I had seen her at the hospital, in the waiting room. I had waited in the lounge for 3 days, doing nothing. Waiting. It seemed that from now on, everywhere I went, there were going to be surprising people who would remind me of unpleasant things. In the line at church, she was respectable, as always. She was wearing a full white skirt and a pink shell, and her hair was held back by a gold banana clip. She was blowing air up into her face, her bottom lip pushed out like a pout. "Look alive," Howard whispered, prodding me. I nodded. "Right. Look alive." He had never used that expression before. I didn't like Mrs. Mackesy and her boy lurking behind her skirt. I didn't like them being in line, and on top of it, she was acting as if the service was an obligation, an inconvenience. They didn't belong. They weren't really friends. I knew that Mrs. Mackesy and her husband had gone to Teresa for marriage counseling. I remember thinking that they weren't our kind, that they were the sort who would take their welfare checks and go bet on dogs down at the racetrack. "Alice, move along," Howard said, with the exacting tone of a schoolmaster. I walked the 3 yards to his side. I tried again to think what I was going to do when I got to the receiving line. Should I clasp each relative's hand, or kiss a cheek and pass wordlessly on? What about Teresa's older brother, the one who looked like a thug? He might be waiting for me with a knife up his sleeve. What do I do? I asked my dusty feet. If Howard knew how I felt, he would guide me through the line. I'd rest my weary head on his shoulder and weep quietly, inconsolably. And he'd whisper to me all the way through. I hoped I would cry the right amount. I guessed I should hug Dan, whether or not he welcomed it. He would feel me quivering and perhaps understand my fear. What to say? What to say? I hated that Howard had told me to be quiet. In church, I would try my best to cry enough to make an impression, but not so much that I couldn't stop. Because the service was not much more than a show, like a wedding, a clean and public accounting of the horror and mess that had gone before. I took a deep breath and licked my lips as I rounded the bend into the vestibule. The casket was before us, the white casket with gold trim around the edges, as if it had come with a little girl's vanity and canopy bedset. It was the size of the box Emma's coaster wagon had come in. A person couldn't take it in at once, but had to adjust, by degrees, to what amounted to a terrible glare. Lizzie had been laid inside, propped up by the white satin pillows. Her dress had puffed pink sleeves with bows on the seams, and a yoke with bows across the chest, and a pinafore with lace stripes sewn to the eyelet. They had shut the lower half of the casket. She had been so swollen in the hospital, and they probably hadn't been able to get shoes on her feet or tights. She looked larger than she had in life, and yet there was something almost two-dimensional about her form. The outfit, the silver headband in her hair with five pink roses in a row along the top. All of it made her look like a wedding cake. She would never have stood for it. She would have screamed and thrashed, yanked at the bows, thrown off the headband. I pulled at Howard's sleeve, trying to find his hand so we could run and run. We had to get away. Couldn't stand the heat and the pressure from the crowd to move forward. "Howard," I screamed under my breath. He was staring at the body. The tears running down his cheeks were soaking into his stiff white collar. "My Lord, Teresa looked awful yesterday when I saw her. I made her sit down and tell me all about it." The voice from behind us had a high buzzing quality, like a dentist drill. I couldn't keep from turning to see back around the corner. She was a monstrous old bag with innumerable moles on her face, underneath the powder and the deep pink rouge, a color not found in nature. She had come from a meeting, some happy gathering which required a, "Hello, my name is," sticker. It was beginning to peel and curl along the edges. She was, according to her tag, Mrs. M. L. Glevich, and she had as good as seized me. I couldn't take my eyes off of her. The makeup stopped abruptly at her neck. She was wearing a blue polyester long-sleeved dress that probably had all the comfort of a garbage bag, and thick, dark brown stockings and heavy oxblood red shoes. Brogans, I thought, must be the word for shoes of such weight. She took her large, dark blue handbag and mashed a bug on her arm with it. She and her friend must have cut in line because they hadn't been there before. "You will not believe this," Mrs. Glevich lowered her voice. "Teresa insisted that the undertakers put a diaper on Lizzie." She looked at her friend next to her, tucking a corner of her bottom lip into her mouth, widening her eyes and nodding her head just once. "Teresa got hysterical when the Swanson brothers requested underpants. That sweet girl screamed. I was there to pick up Lois Wright's death certificate for Otis. I heard Teresa with my own ears. I heard her scream." She lowered her voice still further to a forced whisper. "Lizzie's not even toilet trained." The friend shook her head and clicked her tongue against her teeth. "And then Chas Swanson, he took Teresa by the elbow and led her into his office, put his arm around her, said anything she wanted would be fine." "There she is," the friend said, pushing against me to see around the corner to the beer. "Chas Swanson," Mrs. Glevich went on, ignoring her friend, "sees death 2-3 times a week at least, and he was crying himself. I saw him wiping his eyes with his handkerchief after Teresa left." I turned to look at Lizzie again. Her short brown hair was dull and kempt. On her chest, her strange flat hands molded around it, was her bear. It had been pink when she was born, but it was gray now, and the nose had been bitten off. In a circle around the bier were her things. The Sesame Street pop-up toy, the Jack-in-the-Box, 4 rag dolls, a Cabbage Patch preemie named Spencer, a cobbler's bench with one of the pegs missing, and a Fisher-Price barn with the fence, the silo, and the animals set up at their troughs. I groped for Howard's arm, his wrist, his suit coat, anything to grab hold of, and at the same moment something from behind that felt like a large vinyl purse poked me. "No," I said to Howard. "Don't force me." I began to cry as I said again, "Don't force me." I turned around, tripping over the brogans, stepped flat on someone's sandals, and then pushed my way past the sweating people in the doorway. Once I was in the parking lot, I lit out. I ran without seeing, past the cars, down into the ravine, across the highway, and into the Jackson's cornfield. I was sure I could hear her, Mrs. M.L. Glevich, telling everybody, announcing through her megaphone, that the pathologically sick girl was running from the funeral. What a story she could make of it, having seen it with her own eyes. Not to mention the fact that her own steel-toed shoes had been stepped on by the girl herself. There had been no doubt in her mind right off that the tall blonde one was the culprit. You could tell by the eyes shifting, not daring to look at you straight. I ran until I got to a grove of trees, a narrow wooded corridor that rose steeply above the field. I climbed and stumbled, grabbing at thin, tender saplings, breaking them while great clods of dirt rolled down the incline. I kicked a rotting trunk so hard I fell down and sat. My pumps were covered with dirt and dust. I pulled them off, threw them aside. "Come back," I whispered. "Come back." The crumbling earth was rough and uneven and cool. It felt good to lie down. Even up high, the ground was quaking from the traffic out on the highway. I remember hearing a truck with muffler problems roaring in the distance. I remember thinking that there wasn't anyone who could help me, no one who could comfort me, no place to go for forgiveness. I had the notion that maybe, just maybe, the roar was the giant earth-moving machine, the gem of Egypt, coming to pick me up in its massive claw and rock me back and forth, until I was fast asleep. Chapter 5. Nellie stood by the stove frying bacon the morning after the funeral. She was telling me how her world had collapsed when her second son was stillborn. She was carefully turning the sizzling meat with a fork, saying that she had labored 20 hours, and before she could speak her mind, they knocked her out. When I woke up, no one said anything. I asked where my baby was, and the nurses just went about their business. Ho-hum. The doctor came in around 10 and told me. Walt was away on business and couldn't get home because of snow. I knew she was making a valiant attempt to help me come out of myself, to make me aware of the fact that other people had also suffered. I stared at the table, thinking only that Nellie and I were nothing alike. Mother Nature, with her own irrefutable logic, was to blame for the sun's attenuated beginning and premature end. There was no reason for Lizzie's death, no cause except carelessness. "His birthday comes and I still feel the loss," Nellie was saying. "Huh," I said, stirring my cereal. I had long since been the age to inflict damage, and yet I hadn't got used to the fact that my own generation had inherited the earth for the time being. The boy I had shared a post office box with in college was the head architect for a $40 million museum in Fort Worth. It seemed improbable that a 32-year-old knew enough to keep such a large structure from caving in. There was fear and danger in everything, and it was a wonder we weren't all paralyzed by the possibility of death, the threat of disaster and the routine pleasures of cars, toasters, the air, tuna fish, our friends. Nellie might have done something that seemed to her reasonable, such as scrubbing the bathtub with a powerful cleaning agent, only to find that it had leached through to her skin and into her blood and killed her child. Despite my rational mind that had always kept me from faith, In spite of the fact that I had always suffered from what I had in the 1980s been able to identify as low self-esteem, I couldn't help feeling that I was more wretched than nearly anyone who had ever lived. As Nellie prattled on, it occurred to me that Howard was no doubt heaving and sweating in a far field, working, and at the same time keeping his own pain at bay by putting it into a historical perspective. And so I tried, for a minute, to make myself feel smaller and happier than others before me who had been accused. I raced through all of the history I could think of, past the ancient Romans who had certainly sullied their hands with their relations' blood, past the Rosenbergs, the Nixons, John Hinckley Jr.'s parents, past the nameless multitudes serving time for momentary lapses and crimes of desperation. It was no comfort knowing that others had gone before me. It was despicable, I knew, that where there should have been ordinary grief in my heart, there was, in its place, shame and dread. My remorse, my inability to make amends, was undiluted, stronger, I was sure, than those of any of the guilty characters I could conjure or name. I tried to go back and think of all the things I did during the 9 months that might have caused the trouble. Nellie was still talking, laying out the bacon on a paper towel. Even though there wasn't the awareness there is today, I had been careful, and I certainly didn't smoke or drink. It was 8 o'clock in the morning, and Emma and Claire were in the living room in front of the television, within its electromagnetic field, watching cartoon characters beat each other over the head with bananas. "I'm going to march in there," I thought, "and smash the set." Why had we ever allowed the children to watch cartoons? I had always said that letting them sit before the tube was as bad as feeding them a diet of Hostess ding-dongs. And yet, I also was often too tired to think of alternatives. All the harsh words, the spanking, the swearing, being weak when I should have been firm, the panorama, the complete history of what I had done wrong appeared before me in living color. And the garbled profanities thundered in my ears. I pushed my chair back while Nellie was still talking, went straight to the television and punched at the large black buttons. The image sputtered and then vanished. "Turn that back on," Emma shouted. Claire chanted, "On, on." When I shook my head, snapping it back and forth, Emma said, "I hate you, Mom. I hate you." "Emma Lamb," Nellie said, coming into the living room with the dish towel in one hand and a plate in the other. "Don't talk to your mother like that." "But I want the TV on," Claire whined. Emma crossed her arms and turned her head, giving her grandmother the view of her exquisite dirty neck and the Goodwin Cro-Magnon jaw. It was perhaps hard for a 5-year-old to respect an older woman who was fixated on her granddaughter's bowel patterns, who referred to the effort as doing your duty. Emma's gaze fell on the Barbie with the long black tresses, and she grabbed it, waving it in Claire's face, tormenting her by the evident fact of possession. "That's mine," Claire cried on cue. "Emmy has mine." I turned right around and went back into the kitchen. Nellie had told me I should eat something. I sat at my place in front of a bowl of grape nuts, small pieces of gravel that would aid my digestion. Nellie had somehow turned the clock back 100 years. She was the farm wife, the unsung heroine, up at the first glimmer, making a cake for noon dinner. She lived by the creed that there was no wound or woe an angel food cake couldn't heal or conquer. The 25-pound sack of flour was bursting from the cupboard, and all the new clean, glinting jello molds were stacked against each other on the drain board with the symmetry of a chorus line. There was a leg of lamb thawing on the counter, and the green onions, miraculously salvaged from the dead garden, drying on a napkin. There was food everywhere I looked. There seemed to be enough time to pickle and preserve and nourish. I was dimly aware of Nellie, luring the girls to literature in the living room. Their voices were far off, as if they were ghosts of little farm girls from long ago. The day before, I had lain in the thicket for quite a while, until I realized that the light was fading, that once it was dark, I might not be able to find my way out. I was walking along the road, halfway home, when Howard drove by. I hadn't realized at first that he had passed me. He slowed down and pulled over to the shoulder. He sat looking at the dashboard while I crossed in front of him, shuffled around to the passenger side, and opened the door. I felt as if I'd been called to the principal. My heart was throbbing in my throat, and I wanted to bury my face in my hands to tell him through my fingers and my sobs that I hadn't meant to, that it was a mistake. He waited for the click of my seatbelt before he signaled. He drove, leaning forward, his nose nearly against the windshield, as if he was worried he might run over an ant. I scratched and scratched at my ear, although it didn't itch. He parked next to Nellie's Oldsmobile Achieva in the driveway. He took the key from the ignition and remained seated, staring at our beautiful white barn and the gleaming blue silo nestled into its side. "There were 4 grown men carrying Lizzie's casket down the aisle," he murmured, "when one would have done. When my father died, it was sad, but nothing like this naked grief." I had blocked my ears, said I didn't want to hear another word. "That's fine, Alice," he said, turning to me. "But if you're going to be dramatic, you're going to have to pay the..." "Don't you think I know what that old bitch Mrs. Glevich is talking about right this minute?" I had shouted. "She's telling everyone. Alice Goodwin, the girl who drowned the baby, stepped on my Brogans as she ran from the funeral. Alice Goodwin didn't have the moral fiber to pay her final respects. Don't you think I know?" I had screamed. I didn't ordinarily raise my voice, but there was a thrill to the misery when it came at such a pitch. "Okay, Alice," Howard had said. "Calm down. Forget it now. Let's go get into bed and forget it." I had looked at him, at his eyes that were too close together, as if they were snaps to hold his nose to his face. "Right," I had said. "Forget it. Is that what I'm supposed to do, Howard?" He had been ducking his head to get out of the car and hadn't heard me. "What are Brogans, anyway? Alice, why do you let total strangers drive you batty? They don't know you." But I knew better. What Mrs. Glevich thought she knew was as potent as truth, and pretty soon would become truth. Word was out about me, and she would take the bits of information and dress them up with her distinctive brand of poetry. I was quite sure that Mrs. Glevich would wave her wand and behold, Alice Goodwin, rising out of Lizzie's ashes, refashioned to fit the crime. After we got home from the funeral, I had run upstairs to get away before Nellie appeared from around the corner. I waited in the hall as the guest room door opened, and her capable stride sounded through the living room into the kitchen. "How was it?" Nellie had asked, after she fussed over the suit, praising its splendor, the colors, the textures, the weight, the classic cut, the fact that it could be worn in every season. Such a suit would never go out of style. "The service, it was..." I could hear Howard letting his shoe drop from his hands to the kitchen floor. "A nightmare." "Oh, my land." There was a muffled silence. Howard was probably telling Nellie about my sudden departure from the receiving line. "At the beginning," I heard him say then, "the pianist played the Requiem for a Dead Princess. That did everybody in. Reverend Neighbor stood at the pulpit trying to compose himself. Finally, he said something like, "These are the times that try our faith." He said that he usually could find a few positive things to say in a funeral oration, but on this occasion, it had been difficult to find the thread of goodness. Dear God. He spent the next 20 minutes trying to prove himself wrong. The glories of heaven, the mysterious ways of the Lord, the lessons Elizabeth was sent to teach. In the end, he said he hoped God had spent some time with the 2-year-old before. The congregation tried to laugh. There was a pause before Nellie said, "Gracious, I think that church needs a new minister. Where's Alice? Is she all right?" I had closed my eyes and leaned against the dresser. Howard's other shoe dropped to the floor. I kept hearing the thunk, reverberating, growing louder and louder, until I had to clap my hands over my ears. I stood at the kitchen window, watching Nellie coax the children into the yard with marshmallows. They weren't going to give up the television without exacting a price, pound for pound. Nellie was having to increase the bribe. I went upstairs and lay on the bed. It was 8 o'clock in the morning, and the sun was shining right on my face, and it hurt again to breathe. It hurt to stand, and it hurt to lie down, and it hurt to open my eyes to the light, and it hurt to shut them and see. There was nothing to do but lie absolutely still and remember music, remember the steps. Howard banged the door and came in the kitchen to find, not the good wife sitting eating a bowl of cereal to ensure regularity, but Nellie cooking eggs and another round of grocery store bacon from pigs that had been fed antibiotics and stressed in cramped quarters. "That smells good, Mom," I heard him say. "Where's Alice?" Nellie was trying to be unobtrusive, trying so hard to be no more noticeable than the sensitive waiter who whisks away the plates and brings on the next course while the young people conduct their romance. There were indications of her presence everywhere. She had dug out shirts that had been stained for years, and they were all soaking in mysterious solutions in the bathtub. She was making Howard's favorite foods to fatten him up, including the fabulous Jell-O recipes which brought together the exotic and the ordinary. She had never thought to teach him to cook, and without a mother or wife, he would have been in danger of starvation. Nellie meant only to sustain, to clean, to help in my absence. But through the ceiling I could see her look, her shrug, eyes rolled heavenward in answer to the question, "Where's Alice?" I heard Howard start up the stairs and then Nellie say, "Let her alone for a little while, Howie." Howie. He was 36 years old. "Give her some time." Bless her heart, I thought, working up the energy to roll over and stretch my arms across the entire width of the bed. She hadn't liked me at the start, and I hadn't grown on her at all over the years. "Bless your heart," I said out loud. I slept until late afternoon, and while I slept, I made it a point to dream of my old life years before. Nellie took the children to the park, the library, and the custard stand in Blackwell. She brought them home and prepared dinner while they sat 2 inches from the television, farther and farther from Dickens and Shakespeare as the minutes pressed on. Although Nellie had been married to a businessman, she was clearly born to be a farm wife. Dairy farmers need wives who like to cook bacon and make stupendous lunches with at least 2 starches, warm homemade bread and corn muffins, 3 vegetables, beans and stewed tomatoes and acorn squash, and slices of hickory smoked ham glazed with brown sugar and pineapples, and cherry pie with whipped cream for dessert, and chocolates passed at the very end. Peanut butter and jelly were not enough for a man who was feeding the nation. Nellie wore a white lace apron she had brought from home that hung like strings of beads around her neck. Her gray hair was held in a bun by clear plastic hairpins. She was wearing support hose and white cushioned shoes that had been fashioned by a podiatrist. She could tend the dairy farmer, fix him his cocoa on the winter mornings when he came in from chores, kiss his forehead, and sit him down in the lazy boy so he could listen to the weather radio. They could put me up in the attic where I could grow old in peace, shrieking only at night, like Rochester's mad wife. At supper time, I came downstairs. Howard was still out with, as we fondly spoke of the herd, his ladies. I should have been helping him. The women and children sat and ate and mopped up the sweat rolling down our faces. I took a warm white roll from a basket lined with the red and blue checked cloth. The house was going to rise on a waft of hot air. Nellie would open the oven door just one more time, and the blast of heat would dislodge the house from its foundation, and we would sail over Wisconsin and drift south to Kansas. I sank my teeth into the soft, doughy roll, and it collapsed like a pricked balloon. It was impossible to chew what felt like thick, dry cotton in my mouth. "Excuse me," I whispered. "Where are you going?" Emma called. She followed me into the bathroom, watching me spit into my paper napkin. "I'm sorry, Nellie," I said when I'd returned. "I think I'm sick." Claire wrinkled her nose and said, "Why did you turn off the television?" I should say something of comfort. I will stop feeling so sorry for myself tomorrow, I promise. Lizzie prefers heaven to earth. Your father's obsessive devotion to his herd and his crops is nothing compared to his love for you. But I sat at the table without saying a word. Howard put them to bed. I heard him in Emma's room, playing his clarinet. He played "Ain't Misbehavin'," while the girls danced around him in their white slips. "Play Don't You Touch My Mojo," Emma shouted. Instead, he played the beginning of "Rhapsody in Blue." The clarinet sounded like a siren from way down at the firehouse, sending out the call for help. The second morning after the funeral, Howard slapped his coveralls on the entry floor. He took the stairs by twos up to the bedroom, the thundering of his boots inspiring fear and trembling, just as if he were shouting "fee, fi, fo, fum" over the racket of his ascent. "Alice," he said, sitting down beside my head, "it's time to get up." He didn't sound angry. He wasn't shouting. He was never one to pick a fight. If someone asked him, I'm sure he would say we had never had a cross word in our life together. He was looking at me dispassionately, I thought, the way he might watch a middle-aged bank clerk count his deposit. Although I had most often felt that our marriage was safe, I, and surely he as well, had grievances, complaints, Teresa assured me, which were normal in any relationship. I had married Howard knowing that nothing made him happier than the sight of milk surging through the pipes to the bulk tank. I suspected later that when he had first looked into my eyes, so long and so intently I blushed and felt faint, he was actually thinking of milk price supports. The milk barn was his war. He was the general and the cows were his soldiers. He ran them through their maneuvers twice a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. Although I had known the dairy life was his dream when we were married, I didn't fully understand the demands of the day-to-day routine. I usually had enough presence of mind to remember how satisfying it was, juggling my jobs, helping to keep Howard's dream afloat, his idea of the good life that was far better than any I could have imagined for myself. But I confess that on occasion, in moments of fatigue or worry about money, I lay in bed, plotting his punishment. The children and I would cut him out of our lives, leave him to the cows, if that's what he wanted. I would cash in our one IRA and go to Greece, walking naked along the white beaches, and not only drink goat's milk for lunch, but like it, love it. We would be revolted by the sight of the cow for all of our days to come. We would turn brown and dance like Zorba. Is there someone you could call, that you could talk to about this? Some old friend who could help? He was asking me. It was such a sensible question, so like Howard to think of the obvious path. I slunk down under the sheet. My Aunt Kate would have come if she were alive, and she would have had us cutting up quilt squares on the kitchen table. She would have the sewing machine going at 80 miles an hour while a fragrant concoction with a ham hock simmered on the stove. So that I wouldn't cry, I blurted, "The crazy dentist!" I could call the crazy dentist from our folk dancing days. He had hair like Bozo, honest to God, red tufts that stuck out on each side of his head, and he always wore these horribly greasy checked pants, and the zipper was perpetually half-mast, and he never opened his... "Alice," Howard said, "we have to get on with things." "Things?" I wasn't the least bit interested in things. "It's you I want to talk to, Howard," I might have said, if I hadn't been so weary, so dispirited. I had disgraced myself so thoroughly that there was not much chance of redemption. Couldn't he see that I was alone, utterly solitary in that disgrace, as singular as the first village leper? I had been in error for half my life, wrecking whatever came my way. I wasn't patient and wise with my own children, or the children at school. Our house was sinking into the ground, and I stood watching it crumble around us, without the energy to take caulk and scraper and paintbrush in hand. "Teresa called a while ago," Howard said. That news startled me, and I sat up. I couldn't imagine going to Teresa's, yoo-hooing and putting the copper kettle on, sitting down at the oiled butcher block table and waiting for her to come down the stairs with her only daughter trailing after her. In all the years we'd lived in Prairie Center, I'd managed to make only one real friend. I didn't have any reserves for lean times. How would we be neighbors now? I wondered if we'd avoid each other in the grocery aisles, going the long way home so we wouldn't pass on the road. "Mom is leaving for Romania next week," Howard said, in the soothing tone he used with the cow when it's having trouble delivering. "It's time to get up." "I can't," I said into the pillow, wittingly using the short sentence that had been forbidden in Howard's formative years. I spent the next 2 days sleeping. I told myself that I was resting from the rage of parenting, that I had been shattered by my squabbling children. I had been exhausted without realizing, and now I couldn't move another inch. At night, wide awake, I prowled the house. The plangent strains of the clarinet drifted up from the front porch, where Howard was playing. I stood by Emma's bed, wiping the sweat off her forehead and gently pulling the thumb out of her mouth, hoping to spare us the cost of the orthodontist. I adjusted the fan so it blew to the place she had moved. In Claire's room, I kneeled and looked through the slot of her bed rail so that I could get a better look at her puffy face. Claire was going to be the beauty. Her lips were parted, and a fine thread of drool seeped from the corner of her mouth. Her eyes weren't shut all the way, and I could see the white luster between her lids. I stuck my hand through the bar and felt her dimpled fingers. When they were grown, our children would freely offer their objections about their upbringing. They would sit me down and tell me what I had done wrong, itemizing my character flaws. The time would come when they would outdistance me in every way. They would be far smarter than I, wiser, better adjusted, generous, all the good things from their father. They would know how to navigate through the world. I would have to listen and admit that they were right. They would never forget the time I had tried to beat the milk of human kindness into Emma, shouting, Be nice to your sister, as I spanked her bare bottom. I wondered if they would forgive me my inadequacies. After I checked the girls, I drew on pants and a sweatshirt against the mosquitoes that bred in the dew. I walked through the hayfield. If a person squinted, the lights up in the subdivision looked like the Dipper, Cassiopeia, the swan. You used to live there, I said to Lizzie. Lizzie Collins of Prairie Center, Wisconsin. At Christmas, your house has the star on the roof. That's how you'll know it. Your neighborhood association has strict rules, and they only allow white lights, and they can't twinkle on or off. So your star will stand out both from the heavens and from the rest of the town's garish displays. I saw the life that might have been Lizzie's moving along the dark horizon. She was round and rosy, and her mother always did her best to dress her up. She might well have been in the pack of girls who in kindergarten start out with clapping games and jump rope stunts and end up years later as cheerleaders and student council members. She might have been just as we all dreamed to be. I could see her at 16 in the tall grass behind the baseball diamond, willing the boy to kiss her, it being worth the jigger bites. Maybe Dan and Teresa knew what they had learned from Lizzie. But I couldn't think what lesson there was that might even begin to compensate for her loss. I stood watching the bedroom lights going out, one by one, until there was nothing but the halos from the yard lights, meant to frame the burglars as they tiptoed away with the VCRs. Surely there was a formula. If I do blank, Lizzie will come back. The act of contrition was just beyond my grasp. If I stared at the pond, at the haze of insects fluttering over the surface, it might come to me. I will close my eyes, I thought, and wish hard. I will hear a noise, like fish jumping. And when I look, I'll see Lizzie coming to the surface, shaking off her pink scales, finding her new arms to do the breaststroke to shore. Four days after the funeral, Nellie announced over the lasagna she had made, Howie's favorite, that tomorrow she would have to go. "I'm not sure I should leave you," she said as she walked around the table, putting a hunk of garlic bread on each of our plates. "We'll be fine, Mom," Howard said. "I could call tonight and tell them, 'We'll miss you, but we'll get along. They're counting on you.'" At the end of the meal, Emma was inching her hand toward Claire's placemat, and Claire, uncharacteristically, let out a gorgeous and savage scream. "Girls!" Nellie breathed. Howard reached for his J.I. case cap on the counter and said in his usual terse way, "You two, we're going for a ride." When the car started, the muffler sounding its call, Nellie cleared her throat and adjusted herself in her chair. She and Howard had planned this time for our little talk. I knew it, could see the pleasure of conspiracy in her big, sincere face. "Alice, dear," she said, wiping her mouth with a napkin, "I can't help worrying about you. You're going to hurt yourself, sweetheart. You've just got to be more positive. You've got to stop thinking such black thoughts." I knew what she was going to say next. The words were going to barge out of her mouth. "In a time like this, Alice, dear, a woman still needs a mother. And if there's anything you want to talk..." "I had my Aunt Kate," I said, before she could speak. "She wasn't mother, but I adored her." I pulled on my sandals, huaraches they were called, with soles made in Mexico from old tires. They looked like something a dog had gnawed and buried and dug up and gnawed again. "She bought me these sandals at a folk fair, and they're still good after 15 years. It wasn't nice to say to poor Nellie. She loved everyone to look their best, to be brushed and clean and polished and polite. I was cursed to her, I knew, disheveled, beaten down. Nothing that a good attitude couldn't improve if only I would try. "I'm going out," I said, putting my hands on her shoulders, wishing one gesture could make amends. At the water's edge, the mosquitoes bit my forehead and flew up my nose. I closed my eyes and listened for the slightest ripple, for the break of water. We would someday swim in the pond again, but it was hard to imagine how we'd have the nerve to break the taboo for the first time. It was horrifying to think of putting our mouths to that particular water, letting it touch us. Teresa, I thought, probably wouldn't ever be able to walk down the lane, or maybe she wouldn't want to come to the farm at all. When the gnats became intolerable, I made my way around the pond and into the woods. It was an old-growth forest, the bur oaks, hickory, walnut, and red oaks towering to the sky. And underfoot the May apples, Dutchman's breeches, wild ginger, poison ivy, shooting stars and trillium. The canopy overhead protected the wildflowers from the sun, and the wavering golden light that came through was laced with swarming insects. I thought of the other deaths I'd lived through. There had been my mother, my father, my Aunt Kate, and a woman I'd known slightly in college. Grieving for those people had entailed also a general wonder and fear of death, for one's own death, for the inevitable end as dust. Lizzie's death, a child's death, I considered, should be at removed from oneself, the grief more pure. I wished I could forget her for just a minute so that I could take a walk or be with the girls or cook a meal or wash my face, without feeling the weight bearing down on my shoulders, the leaden yoke around my neck, so heavy I felt I must stoop. I came to the stand of sumac in what used to be a clearing. Beyond lay the orchard that had not been pruned or cared for in 15 years. Howard had thought each spring that finally he would have time in the coming season to trim and spray and pick the existing apples, as well as plant new varieties. He was forever optimistic, forever deluded. The 20 trees seemed to lean toward me, their gnarled bent forms like old men gathered together in the village square, whispering. They were judging me, I was sure they were. They frightened me until I looked straight at them, at the flaking bark, at the denuded spots where deer had nibbled. There had been no discipline, no guiding hand in the tree's rampant growth. Each bough greedy for light and space, suckers spearing through to the heights, all a tangle, a glut of regeneration. I didn't ever want to go back to the house, to Nellie and Howard. Better to stay in the orchard and be judged by the old trees who thought themselves stern, but were ineffectual, temperamental as brats. I pulled myself up into the crotch of what I thought was a mackintosh, and then I climbed to a higher limb. I tried for the 1,000th time to think where I could go to get better, where there might be someone or something to receive me if I ran away. I could at least sleep in a sling, hang it from a branch like an outlaw, and wait until morning, when Nellie would be gone. There was a wood thrush in the distance, singing its love of beetles and berries, summer and twilight, and there came the faintest breeze in my face. The apple tree felt hospitable, and for just a bit I didn't feel quite so sick. I didn't hear anything but the bird and the rustle of the wind, and there was peace because it was hours before I'd have to go home again. I didn't hear the twigs breaking, didn't hear the tread of feet over dry grass. The noise of the cry struck and rang out in whorls through the night. No word, but terror was in the center of it. And even as it rippled away, the sense hung in the air. I slipped, caught myself for a second, before I saw Teresa. And when she came clear, I actually fell, spreading my arms out and sliding, scraping my back to the ground. She was about 10 feet away in the next row. Her open mouth was twisted. But she had made her noise, and the quiet was like the silence after a car accident, when there's nothing but smoke coming from the wreck. She'd scared the bejesus out of me with her scream, but I wasn't going to let on. I stood up, absently dusting myself off, my mind racing, trying to think what to say. Something about running from the funeral, about Mrs. Glevich. Something about how I was always thinking of Teresa, always thinking of Lizzie. That was what I was doing, always thinking of them. I began. "You scared me," she said with tears in her voice. She was walking around in circles, patting her chest, breathing so heavily I thought she might hyperventilate. "I'm not up to a fright like that." "I'm sorry," I said meekly. She dug in her shorts pocket and produced a pack of Camel Lights and a folder of matches. That Teresa carried cigarettes around was as unlikely as Reverend Neighbor having cocaine on hand for his visits to the elderly. I couldn't help jerking my head back out of surprise. I know," she said. "Just a few now and then when I'm alone. It's a habit from my bad girl days at St. Ben's, sneaking a pull in the John. It's helpful right now, like an old friend." She put the cigarette to the corner of her sagging bottom lip, struck a match against a cardboard match paper, and managed, when the flame was almost to her thumb, to get it started. She leaned against the tree in the next row. I didn't know what else to do but edge my raw back to a resting position against the Macintosh. It was an odd thing to be stuck with someone, as if we were in the confines of a stalled elevator. When we had 400 acres, plenty of cover, any number of good hiding places. "It's hard for me to see you right now," she said quietly. "It hurts so much. I sometimes come down to sit near the pond, but I mean not to disturb you. I called the other day, and when the phone was ringing, I realized that I couldn't talk to you at all. It's something I'm struggling with, along with everything else. This business of how to take up life, how to start out again. I'm praying half the day." I wanted to apologize, not only for Lizzie's death, but for the disturbance at the funeral, and for scaring her just then, making her think there were ghosts in the orchard. "I'm sorry." She was exhaling, waving her hand back and forth. "There's nothing to say. That's one of the terrible things for both of us. I know you're sorry. And like the good girl I was raised to be, I'm even sorry you're sorry. I haven't been able to think too much about you, Alice. But I know I will. That the time will come when I'll probably feel your pain, too. Father Albert talked with me about you. He made me take note. I do know your pain is there, that it must be fierce. I hurt so much I can't even think." "I know," I whispered. I started to sidestep away because there was clearly nothing to be done. I had thought that I'd been as good as dismissed, that our unexpected meeting was over, that there would be no more visits for a long time. But I was held there, not only by her very real presence, but also by the idea of her. I thought we had sometimes seen ourselves in the other, that we were more alike than we acknowledged, that we started from much the same lump and might have turned into something quite like the other if we'd been switched at birth. I had been brought up to be off balance, and was. And she had been raised to hold all things in perfect equilibrium, something that was so unusual it too was beyond the norm. I yearned to keep myself straight and in order, but of course never could. And she longed, without any success whatsoever, to let herself go, to let everything occasionally fall to pieces. We were leagues apart on the outside, and I think we were amused by the differences. The variation that had been wrought perhaps most of all by circumstance. We had understood one another, felt a sympathy, an affection, as well as been critical of the other's idiosyncrasies. We were friends in a deep way, in a way that involved obligation and trust, a solid faith in the other's love. I had never had a friend like her, and I felt her life moving alongside of mine in much the same way I felt my husband's days and passages to be a complement to my own. Only with the prospect of her letting me go had I begun to realize how important she was. She took another pull and choked. "Damn," she said between her hacks. "I've forgotten how." "You'll remember," I said, the first words of comfort I had offered her since Lizzie's death. "You'll remember," I said again, coming out from the trunk. She began to talk, apparently not realizing that I was trying to take my leave, that she had said I should go. "It's awful," she said, "losing my daughter and feeling that I've lost you too. I don't feel that you're gone exactly, but that you're misplaced. I've never felt so alone. I keep thinking, I've got to tell Alice. And then I realize that I can't call you. That there is this pain in my chest, like my breast is being cut clean through." She put her head down to her knees and let out one thin wail that sounded like the far-off call of a loon. "Isn't it terrific," she said, righting herself, "how much a person can cry?" She looked out at the woods, the tears running down her face. "Isn't it phenomenal how long it goes? And then there's this period of the strangest calm, grace, it must be. And then it comes on again, all that sorrow. And you feel as if you're not a big enough vessel to contain it?" I nodded. There were hundreds of tiny, malformed apples in the Macintosh, each the size of a thimble. I didn't know about grace, but I had nearly been swept under numerous times. "I walk down to the pond every night because I think of her there. I sit looking at the water and I sense her. I really do. If I can only keep her in focus, hold her there, I'll be all right. I'll be all right." She took a long drag. She was talking out to the orchard, as if the trees had come to stand in straight rows for the purpose of listening to her. I felt sure that even if I hadn't been present, she would still have been talking to the grass, the birds, the possible spirits. I slunk back into the unyielding trunk of the tree. "I drove to Nina today to talk to Albert Satinga," she went on. "Everyone says I have to get on with my life and keep busy. Take a vacation, get a puppy, plant a garden." I smile and agree. God, I was so well brought up, it makes me ill. Inside, I'm screaming at the advice. "My sister signed me up for volleyball on Wednesday nights and a counted cross-stitch class at the sewing center. She's only trying to be kind, but I just wish they'd all leave me alone. Dan has been getting up at 4 o'clock and going to the dairy shrine." I could picture him in his basement office, his ceramic cow knickknacks facing him on the desk. I wondered if he could work, if sometime months from now he might unveil an exhibit, a surprise to the community, a brilliant installation about the invention of the threshing machine. It was also conceivable that he might sit down in his office for a year and have nothing to show for himself. I had been afraid of Dan at first. After the days in the hospital, I hadn't feared him less, but I began to be frightened for him as well. He may have tried to look unflinchingly at the possibility of the endless dark hole, the hereafter, not so much for himself, but for his little girl. Most of the family would probably have hoped to find solace in the conventional images of heaven. Although I hadn't yet visited Lizzie's grave, it certainly would have had all the crudeness of the earth, of planting a seed or burying a hamster. Teresa had talk and inborn strength on her side. There she was, talking at me in spite of the knife slicing through her breast, and the fact that theoretically we had nothing to say to each other. I didn't know if Dan could look into the abyss without falling in himself. She was alternately wiping her face with her hands and dealing with a cigarette, which seemed conspicuous and awkward to her, something ill-fitting and new that requires an adjustment, like walking for the first time in high heels. I started to ask if someone was planning activities for Dan, but she didn't hear. "Yesterday," she said, "I just had to see Albert. It's crazy, I know, but I had to. I left Audrey with my sister. I made an excuse about how I had to go settle with the insurance company and finish out a staffing at the office, since I'm not going to work anymore this summer. I couldn't wait to get up there to see Albert." I was looking in on a private moment. It wasn't for me, Teresa resting against the tree, smoking and talking. I felt I shouldn't look at her. It was logical that she should go see her old friend, Albert Satinga. He had been a priest at the parish church, as well as Teresa's English teacher at St. Benedict's High School. He had been in his middle 20s at the time, stocky, she'd said, solid, with black eyes and what still looked like peach fuzz growing over his ruddy cheeks. At 16, Teresa thought he was the most intense person she had ever known, that no one in Prairie Junction could hold a candle to the beauty, the faith, the poetry of Father Albert. As sponsor of the school yearbook, he had students on the roof hanging upside down to photograph the gargoyles. Teresa, I knew, had worshipped him then, and she had merely loved him 7 years later, when he was defrocked for several reasons, not least for passing out subversive literature to students, The Catcher in the Rye, for example, and no doubt most of all because he had been smitten by a confessor, sight unseen. He was fascinated by the nameless, faceless woman's stories of life with a brute. For weeks he scanned the nave from the pulpit during the 6 a.m. Mass. Her voice was low, an excellent thing he knew in a woman. He couldn't have asked for more one Monday morning when a creature with unnatural blonde hair, stiff as bristles, thrust her fragile, gloved hand into his already in motion priestly handshake and murmured, "Father Albert." 4 months later, Albert left the church in disgrace, and a year later his marriage, which had hardly begun, was over. Teresa tended him up to the brink of a nervous breakdown. Afterward, when he was out of the hospital, he went off to Red Wing, Minnesota, to learn how to repair band instruments. Now he was living in Neenah, Wisconsin, working at a music shop repairing valves and worn pads on clarinets and French horns, flutes and tubas. "I just didn't have the time or privacy to call him between the hospital and the funeral," she was saying. "I don't know how I got through the work of arranging the details, the coffin, my God, the dress, the shoes. My mother was hysterical for all of us, I think. I still feel as if I'm moving, that it will take a long time to come to a complete stop. That's why I need to visit the pond, to get a grip. Every now and then I'd feel a moment of calm hovering above the lunacy, as if I was somewhere between Earth and Lizzie. It was so strange, shopping for her. What color would she like? What fabric? As if she was going away to college. Imagine Lizzie going to college. For a split second, I considered it a possibility in the far-off future, that she might return to go to Vassar or Smith, because a girl, no matter what was hindering her, couldn't pass up that experience. I needed to leave the orchard and go home to Nellie and Howard. Their censure and good intentions would be easy to suffer compared with this conversation that wasn't meant for my ears and to which I could offer nothing. She bent down to put her stub in the dirt. I had to go up there, out of the main drag of Neenah, to the instrument repair shop. She lit another and threw the match into the bleached grass. "Alice," she said, turning and looking at me for the first time. "Sometimes I get the queerest feeling. It always lasts for just a minute. It's that we are all as expendable as kittens. Do you ever get that?" I was surprised and then appreciative that she directed a question to me, and I nodded vigorously. "God," she said, shaking her fists, "I really hate that feeling." She pulled a handkerchief from the pocket that seemed to contain no end of interesting things and demurely blew her nose. She wasn't exactly facing me, but she had changed position, her side, instead of her back, to the tree, so that an observer would have had the impression that we were having an interchange. "I went to the repair place, and I stood by the window looking in on Albert in the workroom, lumbering around, pawing through the drawers filled with gaskets, you know, parts. He stuck his oily hand into a drawer and pulled out some sort of greasy pipe, turned it over and over, like coons do in the garbage. I kept thinking he was some kind of animal. I couldn't help it. His red shirt had a white Albert sewn in cursive on the pocket, like gas station attendants have. Can you believe it?" She didn't wait for me to answer. She had become as extroverted and manic as I had become introverted and slow. She wasn't all right. She was like an animal herself. Something that's got a foot stuck in a trap and is going so wild it can't figure out what limb is hurting. I wondered if she would tell the story to anybody she saw on the street, or sit down at Dell's, the diner in town, talking at everyone who came in for coffee, whether or not they wanted to hear. I looked at the sheet music until the woman in the shop was busy with someone else, and then I charged through the door to the back. I put my head down on that greasy counter and I couldn't stop. I just sobbed. I sobbed. "Father, forgive me, for I have sinned." "You did?" I said, unable to suppress my astonishment. She shook her head back and forth, exhaling a tremendous blast, her bottom lip jutting out so that the smoke went up into her face. "Old habits die hard," she said, "especially old Catholic habits. I'll bet he hadn't heard anyone call him Father in 10 years. "What did he do?" I could tell he didn't know about Lizzie. I thought someone might have called him. He was sort of in shock, I guess, seeing me in the middle of his workplace. I was crying my head off, bawling him out, screaming like a madwoman, telling him the repair shop had no business hiring someone as inept as he was, that he should, she hiccuped, be corrupting youth with good books and leading young girls to the Holy Spirit. She doubled over and coughed into both hands, and I thought, although she was several feet from me, that I should go thump her on the back. When she stood up, she walked toward me, holding on to a branch as if it was a guardrail. I could never tell Dan about it, or my sisters. They thought he was lecherous. "You're the only person who really knows about Albert." It was folly to take the compliment to heart, but I couldn't help feeling pleasure for a minute in the secret, in her trust. "I swear," she said, "that even among the instruments, under his bright Albert shirt and his strained pants, he's huge. I mean, he's absolutely enormous. I swear that in the midst of all the grease and glue, his holiness shines through. He's fat, he needs a haircut, but you can't help knowing you are in the presence of the Holy Spirit."
This ends Disc 3.